We're going to get started. Welcome, everyone. So yesterday, we finished, without me, the first chapter of Tardis, this sort of like this scary progression of fast when there's no, when the drought gets more and more severe, this steady progression of severity, making the fast even worse. I just want to say one thing, but just to make sure we point this out, which I think is actually really one of the things I think is really interesting is the way the rhetoric of this chapter changes as it goes. It starts off by saying, oh, it comes to the 17th of Marcheshvan and there's no rain. Then you start the fast with a few people, not a ton of people. Then it gets to Kislev 2 weeks later, and then Lo Yaradu Gushamim, there's no rain that fell. That's how it talks about the first two times. Then it gets here. This is now past the Lo Na'anu, and they were not answered. It's a totally different way of thinking about it. The Yaradu Gushamim is just a fairly matter of fact, and there was no rainfall. This is adding a whole theological and value-based assumptions to it, which is to say God didn't answer them, didn't see fit to answer their prayers, and that's why there was no rain. So that rhetoric switch is very, very interesting, and it actually gets even worse over here when it starts talking about people as Kivnei Adam Hanazufin Lamakom. These people who were sort of rebuked by God, they were just exiled. And in some ways, this last set of fasts, I think, is actually like encapsulates a lot of what we are kind of feeling right now, even though we wouldn't necessarily talk about it in this language. Because, you know, this most severe of fasts, like all the shops are closed, business has ceased, your life ends, basically. There's no, you don't go to the bathhouse, you don't get married, you don't, in the last stage here, right? Yeah. You don't do business, like everything, it just, you don't even greet each other. Everything gets shut down. The whole of your life is on pause. And the reason is because we're like, feel rejected by God. Like we feel like God hasn't answered us and has put us in this terrible position. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting framework for quarantine in plague, what we're doing right now. Now, we will get to the new chapter. The new chapter begins discussing what the service was like on these fast days. What actually was the prayers look like? It's not totally obvious. There's a whole bunch of fasts that we just talked about. We sort of various levels of fasts. It's not totally obvious to which these Mishnah refer to. Like which level of severity are these fasts? Is this the fast for just the individuals? Is this the fast for everybody? Is this the fast where you can't do anything? You can't get married or so on and so forth? Or just the fast where some of the shops are closed? So like it's a bit unclear. The way it's normally interpreted is this is the most severe of the fasts, the last seven of the fasts. This is the service that will be done on those days, and that the service on the previous fast days would not be so different from the normal shul service. But it's not at all obvious. It could be this is describing the all of the fast days throughout. Okay. Seder ta'aniyot ketzad. What is the order of the fasts? This word ketzad is a great Mishnaic word. It's your little trivia is that it's short for ke'eze tzad, as in like which side. It's a contraction of ke'eze tzad into ketzad. Normally you translate it as how, or in what manner, but basically it's untranslatable. The only way to understand ketzad is to know the answer to your question. So when it says seder taniyot ketzad, we don't know exactly what that question is about, something about what the order of fast looks like. And we'll see that then we'll go to, we'll describe the service on those days. So the question is, what does the service look like? But you wouldn't know that unless you saw the answer. Ketzad is a very flexible word to translate into English. It's just like a nice Mishnaic catch-all for all sorts of different questions. So here it seems to be, what does the service look like? Motzi'in et ha-teva lirchova shel ir, v'notnin efer makle al gavei ha-teva, uv'rosh ha-nasi uv'rosh et beit din, v'chol echad v'echad noten v'rosho. So this is a quite dramatic scene. The synagogue is imagined to be on the town square in the Mishnah. So there's like the town square, which is sort of like the center of everything, and the shul is just on that square. So what you would do is they would take the ark into the town square. They would take it out of the shul, put it in the square, but not in Efer Mikle al Gabi Ateva, and they would put ashes, fire ashes, on the on top of the ark, which is a very striking image, to like literally put a sign of mourning. Like, not only are we mourning, but the ark itself is mourning. The Torah itself is in mourning. Uvarosh hanasiv rosh ha-beitin, and also on the head of the important people in the community. Not totally obvious what these people did or it means here. What the Nasi or the Rosh Avbeidin are, not totally obvious. I think in this context, you would say that the Nasi is some kind of like shul office, like a shul president or something, and the Avbeidin is like the head of the shul's court. This seems to be local offices based in your town and not related to like any sort of grander Nasi or like patriarch of Jews or a leader of rabbinic movement. Doesn't seem to be about that. This seems to be a very sort of local synagogue situation. So yeah, so the point is that like imagine the shul president and they didn't have rabbis, so the shul president and the chair of the ritual committee come out with ashes on their heads. And then everyone else afterwards would also take out ashes. By the way, shul politics hasn't changed that much. It's pretty similar. They have the synagogue service during the drought. They continue synagogue service during the drought. If you remember from last time, they did the fast on Monday, Thursday, which are also the Torah reading days. So this is replacing the shul service on Monday and Thursday. It would Tuesday and Wednesday would look like a normal shul service. Yeah, the main difference between responding to a drought and responding to a plague that we're dealing with now is that they could in fact gather in larger groups for a drought. And if we were dealing with drought, the same thing would be true. So that's the main difference here. But you'll see, by the way, that this, though we're talking about drought so far, it actually sort of becomes slippier later on, more slippery. I suppose it's probably an English word. Okay, so now everyone is walking out there, sort of, there's no chance of rain ruining everything, exactly right. Or if it does rain when you're outside, even better. Like, that's great, you need the rain. So in some ways, you're like baiting God to send rain in some ways. You're like, okay, we're out here, we're going to get soaked. The ark is going to get soaked, the Torah might get soaked. It's like, we're here, like, you know, bring us the rain that we need. Great. That is how the Jewish God works. Yes, exactly. Well, we'll see another example of this later on with Choni, who also tries to like bait God into action. So we'll see that. So yeah, it could be that's what's going on as well. But yeah, certainly their assumption is if it's been a drought for so long, it's unlikely to start raining now. So basically the whole shul is uprooted, right? You leave the shul, everything, the important parts of the shul are taken out, the congregation and the Torah and the ark and the elders of the shul, all of it is taken outside into the street. And all of it is in mourning. Hazaken shebehen omer lefnehen divrei chivushin. And then the eldest among them would say before the assembled congregation, divrei chivushin, sort of words of kibush is sort of to spread, to press or squeeze. So it's like sort of humility words of humility, sort of like and so to make sure that people sort of squeeze their hearts, press their hearts down, which you'll see in a second. The Zaken Shebehen, there's two ways you can understand that. It could be literally the eldest of them, or it could be the most senior in rank of them. Not obvious, because the synagogue had a whole sort of hierarchy, and certain people were higher than others. So it could just be like the shul president does this, as opposed to the chair of the ritual committee, or it could be literally whoever is the oldest amongst the shul elders does it. This, right, elder also has this flexible meaning in English, right? Sometimes elder can mean a high office, and sometimes elder can mean actually old. So same thing happens in Hebrew. And this is what the Zaken would say. This is what the eldest would say. Achenu lo ne'amar ba'anshei Nineveh vayar ha'elohim et sakam ve'et tanitam, ela vayar ha'elohim et ma'aseihem, ki shavu midarkam hara'a. Our brothers. This it doesn't say about the people of Nineveh in the story of Yonah that God decided not to destroy the city because God saw their sackcloths and their fasts. The sackcloth and the fast is irrelevant. That's not what this is about. Ella, the verse actually says, "Vayar ha'Elohim et ma'aseihem." God saw their deeds. Now, the pshat of this verse is God saw their actions, i.e., their actions in putting the fast together that they've. Drasha is, "Ki shavu midarkam hara'ah," because they actually did tshuva. They actually turned away from their deeds. So God saw that their deeds had changed. They'd actually done their tshuva. The point being, okay, great. We're all here. We're all in mourning. We're all outside in the reading, you know, reading Torah and davening. But this actually doesn't matter. None of this matters. The only thing that can make God change God's mind is to change our deeds. And that's what then going to say with a Kabbalah hu omer, the kir'u levavchem v'al bigdeichem. And this is from Yoel, which we already saw, is like sort of becomes a paradigm for fast days, because that's what it's about. It's about calling a fast in response to a plague of locusts. And Yoel extorts his audience to rip your heart and not your clothes. Ripping your clothes would be a sign of mourning. Ripping your heart shows you that you're really actually trying to change your deeds and try to turn your life around. And the Kabbalah, by the way, the Kabbalah is a way of referring to, in this time period, to biblical sources that are not the Torah. It often says "Bakabbalah hu amer" in the Kabbalah, in the tradition, but it's just not the Torah. Then it would say the Torah said, but sometimes Kabbalah is other places in the Tanakh. So basically, like the fanciest, most important person in the shul tells them that basically this fast is irrelevant. None of this fast really matters. We're going through the motions, but all of it is going to be wasted unless we actually change our deeds as well and persuade God to bring us the rain. Through our actual tshuva. This is very similar to the way it works on Yom Kippur today. The Haftarah on Yom Kippur is a part from the prophet Yeshayahu, and the basic point of that Haftarah is it's all very nice that you're here fasting and in shul today, that's great, but actually it's totally irrelevant. Go look after the fatherless and the widows and the people who the vulnerable. Like, go do something. This is not how, God doesn't want this kind of fast, where it's empty fasting without a change in deeds as well. God needs both the fasting and the change in deeds. And the fasting is irrelevant unless you've actually changed your heart. And that's the same thing that's going on here. It's just trying to impress upon the people that the ritual only gets you so far. You need to actually change your deeds as well. The fact that it's like the fanciest person in the congregation doing this, I think is very important. I think that... if you're the eldest or the most highest ranked, the chances are also you'd be one of the richest. To say this to everybody, I think, from one of your richest members of your congregation is I think, very important. But it's not about the pomp and circumstance. It's actually about the inner life, change of the inner life. Okay, so that's what we start off with. So it's all outside, everyone's in mourning. It starts off with this sort of admonition that you need to do tshuva and you can't just rely on your fasting to change God's mind. Then we carry on describing the service. Amdu bat fila, moridin lifnei hateva zaken v'ragil, v'yesh lo vanim uveito rekam, kedei sheyehe libo shalem bat fila. So they now all stand up in prayer. This is when they begin the Amidah, which is the core part of their prayers. Our prayers are really built up of a bunch of different originally totally separate parts. There's like the Shema and its blessings around then. That was done much earlier in the day than the Amidah in those days. That's one part. Pesukei Zimra is another totally unrelated section in many ways. And the Amidah is an unrelated section. We've combined all of these things together, but for them, they were very different. So here we're talking about very much the Amidah. Moridin lefnei hateva zaken v'ragil, somebody who is, elderly, either in the rank sense or the age sense, and ragil is sort of used to leading davening, he would go before the ark. This is just another idiom. We saw over lefnei hateva before. To pass before the ark as an idiom for leading the service. So to hear Moridin of Neateva is the same thing. It's just they brought him down in front of the ark in order to lead the prayers. And the what qualifications this person has, so the first thing is they have to be a zakein, whatever that means, either in rank or in age. Then they have to be ragil, they have to be used to doing prayers because it's going to be different than normal days. And they have to have children, b'yesh lo vanim, uveito rekam, and their house has to be empty. So there's two ways of understanding this. I think that the simplest way of understanding it is Beit Orekam means that this guy has nothing at home to feed his children. His house is empty, like his children will starve unless there is rain, or they're getting close to it. Like he really needs, so in that way, that person would be really into this davening because they really need it. This is like personal for them. It's not just theoretical. It's a personal, they have personal stakes in it. Another way you could read it, which I think is less powerful and probably less like Pshat, but is a way that people have read it, is Beit Orikam is a metaphor to say somebody whose house is empty, i.e. they've got no skeletons in their closet. They are totally sinless. Somebody who's just like, you know, has a lot of merit. And through their merit, they can bring the rain. So those are both interpretations out there. I prefer the first one. And either way, the point is, in order for the person to be, to have their heart totally in the tefillah, they should, it should matter to them. But Omer lifnehem esrim va'arba'a brachot shmona esrei shebechol yom mosif aleihen od sheish. And they would say before the congregation 24 brachot, which is the 18 that you would do in a normal day, and you would add an additional 6. So the Amidah would change. On fast days today, we add an additional bracha sometimes. In the silent Amidah, there's no additional Baruch Atah Hashem, but in the repetition of the Amidah, there is an additional Baruch Atah Hashem. So we do a sort of smaller version of this today, but and the other place we do this most of all is, which we're going to see the parallel in a second, which is Rosh Hashanah, where we add a whole bunch more brachot into the Amidah, like Malchuyot, Zichronot, and Shofarot into the Musaf. So this is a thing that they had more flexibility to do than we do now. But yeah, they're basically like, yeah, it's a troubled day. We need God's attention, so we're going to add extra brachot to the Amidah. Barbara, empty nest. The Uveto Rakim, or Rekam, sorry. It could be. But then it's hard to understand why it's relevant that they have children. I don't know which one of you it was, Barbara or Howard, to be fair. that's Howard, great. So it's hard to know then, Howard, if it's why it would matter if they have children, but their children aren't at home. But it's possible. That's definitely like how I would have read it originally if I didn't think about this has children and what the relevance is for the rest of it. So that's the setup. Not only do they have all this extra ashes and signs of mourning, they also add an additional 6 brachot to the Amidah. And you may be wondering what those 6 brachot were, and wonder no longer, because that's the next Mishnah, goes through the 6 brachot, though there's some machloket about it. But Elohein, here are the brachot that they would do. Zichronot, that's the same thing on Rosh Hashanah. Sort of the remembrance of the covenant, the shofarot, and the blessings about the shofar of deliverance. You'll see that shofar is going to play a large part throughout the Masechet as either an alarm system or like alerting people to the fact that that things are bad, or to some kind of ritual aspects. We're going to see that play out later. So shofarot are very connected to fast days. In the Mishnah. So those are the first two blessings. So they're just the same as the ones in Rosh Hashanah, it seems. The third blessing would be El Aznei Batzarata Li Karati V'Yaneni, some blessing built up from Psalm 120. And then you would go on to Esayin El Harim, some blessing built up from Psalm 121. It's not clear exactly what the connection is, or like, it sounds like maybe they would just recite the Psalm and then say a blessing at the end. Which we're going to see in a second, what the blessing might be at the end, and some like brief sentence at the end. So it seems like these blessings are basically just psalms with a little Baruch Atah Hashem at the end, but it's not totally obvious what it is. At core, by the way, the Zichronot and Shofarot at core is just a bunch of verses. You can see this in the Mishnah of Rosh Hashanah. It's also just you have to have 10 verses or whatever, a minimum of 10 verses that deal with that. Issue. Notice also that Malchuyot is not here. Malchuyot is not as relevant to fast days. It's not about God's kingship per se. Actually, what's relevant is we need God to remember our covenant and to like help us, and we need the shofar to deliver us. That's what we care about. The Malchuyot is less important, so that no one tries to bring it here. Then it continues on. Makim Karaticha Adonai, that's another bracha. From the depths we called out to you. Very appropriate psalm for this. For this day. Tefillah le'ani chiya atof, again, a different psalm. So those are all of the, and also very relevant to the psalm. All of these, if you looked up these psalms, you'd find that they were extremely relevant to these 7 fast days and in days of distress in general. Maybe you could have a practice of saying them every day. or at least one of them. But there's some machloket here, which is Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Lo hayatzarich lomar zichronot v'shofarot, elo omar tachtehen, ra'av ki hiya v'aretz, dever ki hiya, asher haya devar b'nai l'yarmiyahu, al divrei ha-batzarot. So Rabbi Yehuda thinks that there's no reason to say zichronot v'shofarot, let's keep those special for Rosh Hashanah, it seems like what he's saying. Rather, you can say these passages instead, a passage about famine or pestilence, and droughts. These are just biblical passages, which are not psalms, which are about these natural disasters happening. Yes, we need to remember other times that God remembered. Exactly right. Yes, correct. Right, because we're trying to remind God that God should remember us and has done in the past. Okay, so that's two different versions of what the six blessings should be. One, the anonymous majority opinion thinks that you just wholesale copy Zichronot and Shofarot, and the Rabbi Huda thinks you can replace them with other things. But either way, it seems like this seems to be, according to everybody, not just Rabbi Huda, but according to both opinions, Va'omer Chot Mehen, and you would say the Chatima of the blessings, their Chatimot, their sealing, their seals, the Baruch Atah Hashem at the end of the blessing. I think this came up in Pesachim when we talked about the blessings that need Chatima or don't need a Chatima. So yeah, when you have a Baruch Atah Hashem at the end of a blessing, that's your Chatima. So you'd also have the additional Chatimot at the end of these Psalms. And what are those Chatimot, you might ask? And the answer is, the next Mishnah tells us. So the next Mishnah now sort of goes through each of the blessings and tells us what the correct Chatima would be, what the correct ending of the blessing. I'm just going to... Al HaRishonah Hu Omer. I'll just point out one thing. If the astute among you, if you actually counted the blessings in this paragraph from the versus the previous paragraph, the previous paragraph talked about adding six additional brachot. And if you actually count the number of brachot in this Mishnah, there are seven. Not necessarily totally obvious what the connection is, but it sounds like at least one of these brachot is attached to the normal Shema Koleinu paragraph that we would say during the Amidah. So at least one of these brachot is just one of the normal brachot you would say. So it's like 17 plus 7 instead of 18 plus 6, just to head off any confusion that you might have when we realize there are seven. So this is from the Slichot service. Yes, Slichot service. Well, rather, the Slichot service brought this idea from the Mishnah here and other scenarios like this. So the Slichot service borrows from fast days, it seems like. Al HaRishonah Hu Omer, the first Chatima he would say, at the end of the psalm, or at the end of the bracha that he just said, or the psalm that he said, he would say, Mi she'ana et Avraham b'har Moriah, hu ya'ane etchem b'yishma v'kol tza'atchem b'hayom hazeh, baruch atah Adonai go'el Yisrael. So one who answered, and you see that the same format for all of these, then there's a piyut that we do during Slichot and Kol Nidre, which is exactly on this topic. It's a really great, really beautiful piyut. And there's also another piyut on the Hadar website. You can find a version with also women, because apparently there are God also answered women in the Bible. It just wasn't in the piyut for some reason. But there is a version that you can download from our website that does in fact have it. So if anyone's looking for that, you can you can let me know. Okay. Anyway, Mishnah Abraham Bar Moriah. So the one who answered. Avraham at the Mount Moriah before he was about to sacrifice his son. In other words, the one who prevented him from sacrificing his son Isaac. May God answer you. So this is a prayer addressed directly to the congregation, and may God hear the voice of your crying out on this day. Blessed are you, God, the Redeemer of Israel. So again, so calling for redemption, recalling past redemption of Yitzchak. From being sacrificed. Al Hashniyahu Omer, Mishanat Avotenu Al Yam Suf, Huyane Etchem Vishma Koltzat Chem Hayom Hazeh, Baruch Ata Hashem, Zocher Hanishkachot. So this is a similar theme. Now we're talking about saving us at the Reed Sea from Pharaoh's armies. Just as God answered us then, may God answer you now. And God, blessed is God, who is the remember of the things that are forgotten. The implication being that we are being forgotten right now. And God should remember us. Al Hashlishi to Omer, the third bracha, Misha ana et Yoshua bal Gilgal, hu yane etchem bishma kol tzatchem hayom hazeh, baruch ata Hashem shomea trua. So I think Gilgal is where Yoshua stopped the sun. Stopped the sun in order for the battle to last long enough for the Israelites to win. So this is again another time where God like stepped in to intervene with nature in order to protect God's people. So God could do the same now. And also God here is the hero of the Truah, the hero of our shofar blast, probably. Though Truah has an interesting double meaning. It could either mean a kind of shofar blast with some kind of trumpet. It can also just mean shouting out in general by people's voices. So it could be the hearing of our cries, the hearing of cries, or the one who hears shofar. It could be either. And maybe the double meaning is intended here. On the fourth one, Mishana Shmuel Bamitzpah, Huyane Etchem, Vishma Bakolza Etchem, Hayomaze, Baruch Ata Hashem Shomea Tzaka. So this is a very, Shomea Tzaka is a very, what's the word? Appropriate thing to say on the fast days. This is now we're remembering you will save Shmuel at Mitzpah. Don't even remember exactly what that's about, but you could look it up. I think it's in. First Shmuel 7, chapter 7. We can look at that. Next one. Alachamishit tuomer, Mishanat Eliyahu Bahara Karmel, Huyane etchem vishma bakolza etchem hayom hazeh, baruch ata Hashem shomea tefila. This is now when Elijah defeated the prophets of Baal and called on God to send fire down to his altar. God remembered us then, remembered, helped Eliyahu then, he should help us now. Al hashishi tomer, Mishana et Yona mimei hadaga, huya ane etchem, vishma kol tzatchem, hayom hazeh, baruch ata Hashem haone beitzara. Jonah, who was swallowed up by the fish, God heard Yona's prayers and let him out. So do the same for us. Al hashvi tomer, and this is the seventh one that I warned you about. Mishana et David ve'et Shlomo v'no v'Yerushalayim hu ya'aneh etchem v'yishma b'kol tzatchem hayom hazeh baruch ata Hashem harachem al ha'aretz. This doesn't seem to be a very specific instance. It's just you generally looked after the kings in Jerusalem, David and Shlomo, and so please look after us. You have mercy upon the land. Very interesting way of talking about droughts. Like have mercy on the land, not even us, but the land. Like yes. Maybe you should hear our cries, you should hear our prayers, you should hear our shofar or whatever, but fundamentally, like, you're damaging your own land. So have mercy on the land of Israel. Okay. Thank you, everybody. See you tomorrow. And we'll move on to Mishnah 5, which is a lovely thorny issue.